Welcome to the Allowed Podcast. I'm Louise Steinman, curator of the Allowed series, presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Allowed is a series of dynamic lectures, readings, performances, and discussions that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic Downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. To learn more about Allowed and learn how you can help the Library Foundation of Los Angeles support the Los Angeles Public Library, please go to our website, www.alloudla.org. The Allowed program you're about to hear was produced in 2009. Dr. Abraham Verghese attended the Iowa Writers Workshop in 1990, where he attained an MFA. He'd taken a sabbatical at the time from an active AIDS practice. His first book, My Own Country, about AIDS in rural Tennessee, was a finalist for the National Book Critics Circle Award for 1994 and was made into a film. His second book, The Tennis Partner, was a national bestseller, and he's published extensively in the medical literature. His writing has appeared in many publications, including The New Yorker, The Atlantic, and The New York Times Magazine. In her Los Angeles Times review recently of Verghese's beautiful new novel, Cutting for Stone, Susan Salter Reynolds lauds the integrity of his characters and writes how Verghese makes the point in his gentle way that violence begets violence, that fanaticism is born from pain. It is a story created so lovingly, Reynolds writes, and I concur, that it is, quote, actually possible to live within it, which, I'll confess, is the reason I didn't get very much sleep last night. It's really hard to put down. It's such a beautiful book. Dr. Verghese is now Senior Associate Chair and Professor of the Theory and Practice of Medicine in the Department of Medicine at Stanford University. From my nephew, who recently rounded with Dr. Verghese at Stanford, I know that Abraham is a master clinician, a master diagnostician, elegant, kind, and full of humanism. And after tonight, I'm sure you will agree. In conversation with Dr. Verghese tonight is his close friend, award-winning actor, Hector Elizondo. Hector's successful career spans 40 years and includes film, television, theater, and radio. He has many film credits, including Love in the Time of Cholera, The Runaway Bride, American Gigolo, Tortilla Soup, and both Princess Diaries. In 1997, he won an Emmy Award for his role on Chicago Hope. Hector is deeply involved with giving back to his community locally and globally. He's a mainstay of LA Theater Works and an avid supporter of several charitable organizations, including the Alzheimer's Association, Amnesty International, and the American Cancer Society. And by his appearance here tonight, he also supports the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, for which we thank him deeply. So please join me in welcoming Dr. Abraham Verghese and Hector Elizondo to the LA Public Library. Thank you.
Excuse that false start before. I was trying to recover a book for a photo. So that's why you saw my face leaping out from off stage here. First of all, thank you very much for coming. It's a pleasure to be speaking with my friend Abraham. And in the words of Yogi Berra, thank you for making the occasion necessary. I'll be quoting him from time to time, incidentally. we first met at the Sun Valley Writers Conference. And it was during a conversation that you may or may not remember, but there was a lot of conversation going on. Folks who converse, professional conversers, that you mentioned something that impressed me. You said you were writing a book, and having known something about your background and how busy you were, you said, in order to finish this particular work, it was, of course, one of your first two books, you had to make some changes in your life, in your schedule. Because one of my questions will be, how do you do what you do? How do you fit it in? And what I was most impressed by was, I had to stop drinking wine. I said, now there's a sacrifice by God. But what I was impressed by was how you did it, how you fitted it. I'm always impressed by how one manages one's time and then creates, and not just is busy, but creates something lovely. Now, speaking of something lovely, if I may segue, concerning something very lovely, this is a very, very big book, a very dense and large saga, the kind they don't write much anymore. And I was taken by the ambitiousness of it. I mean, this is a very ambitious work. And a work that that takes you to another place. How many of you have read the book, incidentally? That's not bad. Well, yeah, that's all right. Okay, we're talking about Ethiopia. Right? And it's passionate characters, myriad characters, spanning continents and generations. It's braided in a rich stew and during an intersection of historical turmoil, soon to be the deposed Haile Selassie of Ethiopia, the Emperor of Ethiopia. And all floats for me. What impressed me about it, it seemed to all be floating, and not surprisingly, on a sea of empathy and compassion. And it's a very large vessel for an author with a very big heart, and you filled the vessel very well, my friend. Now, but the book, let's talk about, not so much about the book, because that's not the it of it. I'd like to speak about the heart of the author. In order to understand the heart, the source of all that stuff that flows through the spirit of the book, I think it's best to start from the beginning of the beginning. And the quest of medicine, I'm now going to quote an interlinear quote, and then I'll shut up. All right? Your quest of medicine has, quote, a romantic pursuit, a spiritual calling, a privileged yet hazardous undertaking. And how this pursuit, this calling led you naturally enough, it seems, at one point in your life, to become the founding director of the Center for Medical Humanities and Ethics at the University of Texas Health Science Center in San Antonio, where we had a very, very good time together. Now, the question is quite simply, first, as a layperson, what exactly is, how would you define medical ethics, medical humanities, and ethics? How did this calling come about? What was that road, that venture?
Well, first of all, thank you so much, Hector, for being willing to do this, and such
pleasure.
A joy to have this conversation with you on stage. Thank
More
you all
pleasure.
For thank coming. I'm really grateful. You know, my calling to medicine, I always confess, came not because of some passion for science, but came because of a book. And for me, the book was Of Human Bondage. I grew up in Africa. I grew up in Ethiopia. No television, and for entertainment, I read. I think I was a precocious reader. I remember reading Lady Chatterley's Lover at 11. And I...
My kind of kid.
I picked up Of Human Bondage because the title suggested great promise. Huh? It suggested more of the same vein, but...
One never knows, do one, as Fats Waller said.
But to my great surprise, actually, the story of Of Human Bondage was even more moving than I anticipated. If those of you who know the story, how many of you know the story of Human Bondage? You know, a beautiful book. Mm-hmm. It really portrayed this wonderful protagonist, Philip, who wanted so much to be an artist and goes to Paris and finds to his great chagrin that he doesn't have what it takes to be an artist. In fact, there's this great scene where he invites his art professor to come up to see his paintings in his loft, and because he's starving, he can't even find money for a meal, and he wonders whether he should go on. And he says to the art professor, "Tell me if this is worth my pursuing." And the professor looks at the paintings for a long time and says, "Is there anything else you can do?" Which must have been, you know, heartbreaking. And he goes on to say very quickly, "I wish someone had said this to me, had asked me this question when I was a young artist." And so Philip goes back to London with his tail between his legs and resumes a professional education. There's some money left for him to do that. And he arrives on the hospital wards in his third year of medicine, and he suddenly sees, as Somerset Maugham describes it, humanity there in the rough, the artist's canvas. And that sentence just spoke to me. It suggested that even if one didn't have the talent to be an artist or a mathematician or a physicist, my parents are both physicists, my brother teaches at MIT, so I felt really math challenged. Even if one didn't have those skills, to be a physician, all one needed was an inherent empathy with the human condition and a willingness to apply oneself. At least that's what the book seemed to imply. But the book also managed to portray medicine as being this really romantic, passionate pursuit, one that would give you back as you gave to it. It's a notion that, as an adolescent, I loved. And frankly, it's a notion that's never left me. I still very much see medicine that way. And so when I had you come to San Antonio and speak to our students, it was very, very much with the feeling that literature informs medicine. Literature certainly brought me to medicine. But I still think that, you know, when we want our students to fully imagine the patient's experience, the best way to do that is actually, ironically, through literature. If you want to understand end of life, you can read a hospice textbook, or you can read The Death of Ivan Illich by Tolstoy. And, you know, something about being in that man's shoes, that great lawyer's shoes, and he's dying, and no one is giving him what he wants, not his wife, not his esteemed colleagues. Only his servant understands that what he needs at that moment is pity. So that's sort of a long-winded answer to your question,
but it's
how I came to medicine.
It's not long-winded at all. That's a wonderful segue to this, one of my... I don't have many treasured objects besides my guitar. This is Dr. Verghese's syllabus. Now, when you read this...
This was in San Antonio, not Stanford.
Yes. When you read this, it's all about art and literature. Really. How literature informs. It's a pathway, it's a door to what you do. So I was reminded in the green room, speaking to my folks there, folks, little people. I always, when I use the word folks, I always think of little village people. It's a silly thing to say. that in the people squatting in the caves of Altamira and Lascaux and doing those wonderful, wonderful paintings, the wonderful work, were not doing it as extracurricular activity. They were doing it because they had to. It seems it's something. So it was bone deep, that desire, that need. So so art generally seems to me that you were affected greatly by that.
Yeah, I think so. I also have a strong sense that fiction has a capacity to tell the truth that that many of my fellow physicians I don't think believe. I think I have a lot of physician friends who think, well, I don't read fiction. It's not, you know, it's not serious enough for me. I only read nonfiction. But I love to quote
They haven't read Tolstoy.
I love to quote them Dorothy Allison, a lovely writer who wrote Bastard Out of Carolina. Dorothy Allison says that fiction is the great lie that tells the truth about how the world lives. And I've actually written both nonfiction and fiction, and I think both are really forms of truth-telling, but I have a sense that one has a better chance of getting at the truth through fiction, paradoxically, than through nonfiction. But I agree with you, the imperative to tell story is just inborn, and you know, what greater privilege in medicine than to see stories unfold and then to try and capture the truth of them.
It's certainly a way of becoming human. I know working with the Creative Coalition, we always go to Washington. Well, I used to go to Washington and speak to the members of the Appropriations Committee trying to loosen the purse strings for art and education, making art part of the core curriculum. And they thought it was about finger painting, and it was difficult for us to... perhaps now with this administration we'll have better, more luck. So many questions about your work with as the founding director of the Center for the Medical Humanity and Ethics, and how you you literally trained young doctors to become better doctors by teaching them bedside medicine, which comes from which it resonates in this book, incidentally, over and over again. Your characters are part of a community, but more than a part of, they seem to be almost an organism. they're that close, and they're that driven towards being human beings, in spite of all their particular frailties.
You know, bedside medicine has been one of my monomanias, and I think it comes out in many forms in all my books and my writing. I have a sense, and this is something that I'm coming to more recently, that even though we have better and better ways of getting information about the patient, better and better tests, there remains a vital role for the physician to examine the patient at the bedside. I don't have any illusions. My hand is not better than a CAT scan in revealing what's going on in the belly, but only my hand will reveal pain and tenderness. But more than that, I've become very convinced that the ritual of the bedside exam is a ritual that we can't shortchange. Rituals are all about transformation. We could, for example, we could inaugurate a president without the ritual of the parade and the Chief Justice flubbing his words and all that stuff. We could, you know, just an email from the Chief Justice and there you have it, you have a president. But we don't. We have a ritual because rituals are about transformation and we need the rituals in order to be transformed. So I think very much like marriage rituals, baptismal rituals, the ritual of the bedside exam should not change from antiquity to now. It should remain as sacrosanct, it should remain as important, even though we have better ways of getting at the information. Because if you don't do the ritual, if you don't examine the patient well, I think you don't get the physician-patient buy-in, you don't get the connection that you that you'll get by examining them thoroughly. So that's become sort of central to my dogma. It's something that I'm very concerned about. In fact, I've written that the patient in the bed these days in our hospitals, the patient in the bed has become like an icon for the real patient who's in the computer. You know, and everybody's busy massaging the eye patient, as I call it, in the computer, and the real patient is wondering where everybody is. And I think this is a dichotomy that is really getting unacceptable. And in a funny way, I think our harsh economic times, our soaring health costs, are actually playing into our doing something about this. Because I think that one of the best ways to be cost-efficient in medicine is to take a very good history, get the story down correctly, find out exactly what the patient is there for, examine them very well and recognize the common things, and order a limited number of tests. We typically don't do it that way now. We are almost upside down. We order a battery of tests, and then from those results, we try and sort out what's going on.
And then you discuss the kidney in bed 14.
Kidney in bed 14 or the heart attack in bed 3. My biggest worry is that if you're missing a finger and you come to my hospital, no one will believe you till we get a CAT scan, MRI, and an orthopedic consult. I mean, I'm only partially joking. We have become so locked into technology.
Oh, yes. You mentioned once the difference between healing and curing in context of what we're speaking of.
Yeah, I think that's a very important distinction, which I never tire of talking about. And it's something that I learned the hard way. I came out of my medical training in about 1983 full of what I call the conceit of cure. You know, the sense of Western medicine can fix anything. And if we can't, it's because the patient came too late or the protoplasm is weak or it's certainly not our fault. And I went into infectious disease as a specialty because to me, it was the one specialty in medicine that was all about cure. I mean, I looked at the cardiologists putzing around with their Roto-Rooters and, you know, cleaning out the grunge. And pardon the cardiologists in the audience, I don't mean to be personal here. And I thought, you know, what's the point of that? Whereas infectious disease, you know, you could go and make an astute diagnosis on someone who'd come back from the Congo with hemorrhagic fever and they would rise like Lazarus if you were right. And it was so ironic that a fatal illness like HIV should land in the lap of those of us caught up in that conceit who went into infectious disease. And a whole generation of us learned a very painful lesson, a very humbling lesson. And the lesson that I learned was that even when you had no cure to offer, you had healing to offer. And by that I mean you could offer yourself. It's what the horse and buggy doctor of 150 years ago was doing. And the example I use with my students, which I'd love to repeat here if I may, I tell my students, if you imagine going back home after our little meeting to your apartment and find that someone has kicked down the door to your apartment, robbed you of all your valuables, your money, your jewelry, your computer, your iPod, God forbid, has been taken. You will be devastated. Your sense of loss will be huge. And if the police come by 2 days later and say, we found the person who did this, here's all your stuff back, you will be cured, but you will not be healed. Your sense of violation will be so strong that you might actually leave that apartment. You might choose to live somewhere else. So I think all illness has those two components. There's a physical component, but there's always a sense of violation. Why me? Why now? Even with something as trivial as a broken finger. I mean, it's a broken finger. It'll set in 6 weeks. But we can't help it. We also have a sense of why me, why now. And as in Western medicine, we've done a very poor job of addressing the spiritual violation. And with diseases like cancer, HIV, the sense of spiritual violation is huge. It's almost as big as the disease. I remember in the early years of HIV, I lost two patients who were killed not by HIV, but by what it meant to have HIV. One gentleman, I gave him the diagnosis. His blood test had come back. Sat him down in my office. This is before we had Ryan White and that kind of money and counselors. And I remember counseling him for a good 1 hour. I was very worried because this news had just devastated him, and told him to come back the next day. Instead of which, that night he went to a nightclub and had a shootout with the police, where he drew a gun and they gunned him down. Death by police, or suicide by police, as we call it now. And I always thought that he went out not by the virus, but because of the spiritual violation or what it meant to have HIV in that era. And I had failed to sufficiently monitor and take care of that in the absence of anything I could do for the virus.
So that particular period seems to have been some kind of epiphany for you in terms of the direction you would take in medicine.
Oh, definitely was, yeah.
That HIV AIDS era.
Yeah, I don't think you'd have wanted to meet me in 1984 or so when I was full of my conceit. I really think that the HIV era, as terrible as it was in so many ways, was also the most edifying era, the most humbling era for many of us in Western medicine. It really did a lot to bring us down to what medicine is really all about.
So there you go. So crisis equals danger and opportunity. In this case, it was a right. Perfect segue. Back to a little bit of literature. Incidentally, the book. I don't think I'll give anything away if I mention some of the plot. You know, you think? It takes place in Ethiopia, Addis Ababa, and it's not the. I can do this very quickly here, but it's not all about medicine, and there's a lot of levity here, and could you read a passage concerning the levity in this book?
Are you sure?
Yeah, please. Okay. I would love it.
The last
Just
time
to get
I read
a flavor
this,
of your writing.
The last time I read this particular passage at a Department of Medicine, the chairman came and told me later that there was not a dry seat in the house.
but perhaps that's good. Before you do, I'll just very, very briefly go over the plot for those, because most of you have not read the book. It's a very big, dense, epic book. It's Marion and Shiva Stone are born one dramatic afternoon in 1954 in Addis Ababa. And the same day, their mother, a nun, and this is a lovely, lovely name, isn't it? Sister Mary Joseph Praise dies of complications from her actually hidden pregnancy, right? Her mysterious pregnancy. And the boys are conjoined at the skull. So you can read something mythological into that. Yet separated at birth. They're raised by Dr. Kalpana Hemlatha, a very strong woman known as Hema, and Dr. Abhi Ghosh. Wonderful characters, both immigrants from Madras and both doctors. They are the epitome of empathetic, compassionate, committed people. And both doctors at the hospital where the boys' natural parents also worked. The hospital is called Missing. And it's called Missing because
because nobody can pronounce mission in the local tongue. Mission comes out sounding like missing. And at some point, the Ethiopian Herald picked up on that, and that became the official name of the hospital, and no one could change it.
And no one could change it. Now, they grew up in great political turmoil, and from there, Marion starts his great Chautauqua around the world, and ending up in New York, and I'm not going to give much away, but then the mysterious father who informs the book. You don't see a lot of him, but he's there.
Very much so.
It's the loss of that father, the loss of the parents, especially the father, it drives the book in a very particular way. And at the end, the father appears, and that's all you're going to know about that. I have a feeling that there's another book, there's a sequel here.
Thank you for setting up the reading, because this reading has to do with Dr. Ghosh that he mentioned, one of the internists in the hospital who raises the two boys. He raises Marion, who's the narrator, and his brother Shiva. And Ghosh is an internist, but he becomes the hospital's reluctant surgeon when the boy's father, Thomas Stone, takes off and disappears. And in this particular scene, he's actually doing an operation that he did long before he became a reluctant surgeon. He's doing the vasectomy, and he's teaching a Dr. Cooper from the American Embassy how to do the vasectomy. Can you all hear me pretty well at the back there? So this scene is narrated by Marion, who's about 11 years old at this point. Dr. Cooper arrived promptly at 8 that evening in an embassy staff car, just as the patient, a Polish gentleman, pulled up in his combi. My father, Dr. Ghosh, had learned the technique of vasectomy as an intern, and he'd learned directly from the great Dr. Javer in India, whom he spoke of as the maestro of male nut clipping, who is personally responsible for millions and millions of people not being here today. The operation was a novelty in Ethiopia, and now expatriate men, particularly Catholics, came to Ghosh in increasing numbers for an operation that was uncommon or unavailable in their countries. I have a proposition for you, Dr. Cooper. I shall teach you the vasectomy, and once you are proficient, you can pay me back by doing a vasectomy on a VIP patient, Ghosh said. Do I know him? Cooper said. You are talking to him, Ghosh said. So you see, I have a vested interest in seeing that you're superbly trained. My assistant, Marion, will help me judge your skills. And Marion, not a word to Hema, you either, Dr. Cooper, about my plans. Cooper had a stiff brush cut and overlapping square teeth that looked like chiclets. His American accent was sharp, jarring to the ear, but offset by the way he drawled out his words, by his relaxed, affable manner, as if he'd never had an unpleasant moment in his life and did not expect to. See one, do one, teach one, right, old buddy? Cooper said. Indeed, yes, Ghosh said, it is easy to do, but harder than it looks. Some preliminaries, Dr. Cooper. I tell the patient to use an enema the night before because nothing makes them more tense than being constipated. Warm milk and honey mixed together, put into an enema bag held shoulder high, is what I recommend. Does it work? Does it work, Dr. Cooper? Let me put it this way. If the patient happens to be drinking a whiskey and soda, it'll suck the glass right out of his hand. I also ask the patient to take a warm bath beforehand. It relaxes him, and he added softly, it improves my olfactory experience, you know. The patient had not said a word thus far. He was, Ghosh told me, a consultant to the Economic Commission for Africa, an expert on population control, who happened to be the father of 5 girls. He did not mind all the attention. We can't finish if we don't start, so we better start. Yes, Marion? Turn on the heater, please. But I had already turned on the electric heater under the table. Here is the first caveat, Dr. Cooper. If you don't want the scrotum to shrivel up and the balls to retract to the armpit, the room has to be really warm. Now, the second caveat is relaxation. Very important. A barbiturate or narcotic might help. I recommend an ounce of Johnny Walker, red or black. I'm not particular. A wonderful relaxant. And yes, you might give one to the patient, too. Cooper's laugh rolled leisurely out of his mouth like the great banks of clouds that spilled over the Entoto Mountains. I served the patient his Johnny Walker, which he downed in one gulp. I loved assisting Ghosh. Ever since he treated me as if I were old enough to understand and learn, I took my role very seriously. I was thrilled to have Cooper there watching. Ghosh, on the patient's right, rooted with his thumb and index finger at the top of the scrotum, just where it joined the body. You feel all those wiry things, Dr. Cooper? Lymph vessels, arteries, nerves, whatnot? Well, the vas deferens is in that lot, and with practice, you can tell it apart from all the other wires. It has the largest wall-to-lumen ratio of any tubular structure in the body, believe it or not. Here it is, a whip-like structure. Now put your finger right behind mine. Cooper rooted around and said, got it. Yep, the vas, got it. Now push the vas forward from the back with the tip of your index finger. Fix it like this against the pulp of your finger so it doesn't slip away. Ghosh's instructions to Cooper were identical to what he said to me when I assisted him. He loved to teach, and in Cooper, he had the kind of student he deserved. If he dazzled Cooper with his polished delivery, it was because he'd practiced it on me. Practicing medicine and teaching medicine were completely connected for Ghosh. When there was no one to instruct, he suffered, but that was rare. He would happily teach a probationer or even a family member, whoever happened to be around. I use adrenaline with my local anesthetic, Dr. Cooper, to keep the bleeding minimal, and don't be stingy. He emptied a 5cc syringe of local into the tissue that his index finger pushed forward. Any less than 5cc and he'll have pain and the balls will go to the armpit and you'll have to get the chest surgeon to bring them back down. Now see how my index finger still has the vas stretched over it? I make a tiny cut, I keep pushing, and there it is. I pull it out of the wound, I use an Alice to grab it. He pulled out a short length of pale white worm-like tissue. I put a clip here, a clip there. I cut between the clips. I remove a 2-centimeter segment. Ideally, you'd send it to pathology. That way, if his wife gets pregnant a year from now, you can show the patient the pathology report, and he'll know it's not because you didn't do your job, but because a third party did their job better. I don't send it to pathology for the simple reason that we don't have a pathologist. But for a while, there was a pathologist at the American Embassy Clinic in Beirut, and I would do the vasectomies for the American staff, and I'd send him these little pieces I cut out. The man did the pathology for all of the American embassies in East and West Africa. He kept sending back reports that my specimens were inadequate, that he thought he saw some uroepithelial tissue, but he couldn't be sure it was the vas. It's the vas, I wrote to him each time. What other uroepithelial tissue could I have cut out? Call it the vas, please. But he kept complaining. Cannot be certain. Not enough tissue. It was starting to annoy me, you know. So finally, I sent him a pair of sheep's balls. I put them in formalin. I sent them off in the same diplomatic pouch with a note saying, is that enough tissue for you? I never had a problem with him after that. Now I tie off the ends with catgut, and then I tell the patient, no communication with wife allowed for the next 90 days. Ghosh turned to the patient and he said, no communication allowed with wife for the next 90 days. The patient nodded. Okay, you can communicate. You can say, good morning, darling, and all that, but no sex for 3 months. The patient grinned. Okay, you can have sex, but you must wear a condom. I use interruptus, the patient said, speaking for the first time in a heavy East European accent. You use what? Interruptus? Pull and pray? Good God, man, no wonder you have 5 kids. It's noble of you to try to get off the train at an earlier station, but it's unreliable. No, sir, interruptus unless you want to reach your 6 this year. The patient looked embarrassed. You know what we call young men who use coitus interruptus, Ghosh said. The population expert shook his head. We call them father, daddy, pater, papa, pair. No, sir, I have done the interrupting for you. Give me 3 months and you can tell your missus that she's not to worry because you will be shooting blanks and there will be no more interruptions and you will be staying for coffee, dessert, and cigars.
There, you could also use this as a handbook. There are many interesting medical operations here, but all interspersed and braided by wonderful characters, rich characters. It's just delicious. I couldn't help but think as you were reading for some reason. May I go back to your syllabus here? Speaking of handbook. They're making a smaller one so you can carry it with you all day. All right. William Carlos Williams.
My hero.
Had a feeling. All right. If I may quote, the abstract categorical mind can be wonderful. The glory of the intellect at work coming to its great big and big deal conclusions. But we've got to keep a close check on all that. The head running away with itself. The doctor treating a patient out there on the front line falls back on herself, her own manner of being with people, and she has to come to terms with not only a disease, but a particular person. This patient, not patienthood, not lungs in general, or kidneys, or hearts in general, but one guy,
one gal, one kid who has some trouble and is handling it in a way that may be different than anyone else's way. Now, that particularity of approach and attention is what resonates in this book. And while you were reading, I was thinking of the environment that Gosch and Hema were working in, as opposed to the environment that Marion was presented with and was exposed to when he came to New York.
That was somewhat purposeful. I really wanted to contrast.
And how it led to the hands-on.
Absolutely, yeah. I very much wanted to contrast the sort of bare bones of a mission hospital where there isn't much in the way of technology, there isn't much in the way of resources. And what it does is it does not conceal the nature of the fiduciary responsibility the physician has. It does not disguise the patient-physician relationship. There's something very appealing about that. And then I wanted to contrast it with, you know, Western medicine, which has all those qualities but easily disguised and diluted by all the stuff that intervenes and all the layers of paperwork and this and that disguise that bond. So that was very intentional. But I think that William Carlos Williams phrase is one that I quote to students all the time. I'd say that the single most important tool in your therapeutic armamentarium is not your knowledge of drugs or medicine, but your knowledge of self, to the degree that you can then use yourself as the instrument to bring about the change you want in your patient. And if you're not self-aware, you just can't make that happen that well or that easily.
Because the particularity of the individual you're dealing with informs the doctor.
Absolutely, yeah, exactly.
And therein lies the deal, as they say, uptown New York. I have a feeling that there's another book coming out of here.
You think?
I want to know more about Marion.
He said that to me in the green room, and
what
it's an intriguing
Marion?
Idea.
There's a journey that this person is on, and I'd like to know more about it. I have a feeling it's abiding in the interstices of your creative brain, Abraham. Now, this could have easily led to melodrama, and it didn't. May I ask you point blank, how did you figure that out? How did you avoid that pitfall?
Well, I'm glad that you think it didn't. I've heard some from a few critics who had something to say about coincidence, and I wonder sometimes if critics are more comfortable with thin novels that the number of pages is almost as thick as the title, and title pages, meaning very thin. And this is a big epic story, and I think life is full of
French novels, Duras.
Yeah, I think that life is full of extraordinary things. Life is full of coincidences, and if you're aware and self-aware, things connect back. And so I'm glad you think I avoided melodrama. I had a wonderful editor when I was reading in New York, a wonderful discussion at the Asia Society. A young woman in the audience who must have been, she looked like she was about 14 years old. She stood up and she said, "I got this book on Tuesday at 10 o'clock and I had to call my husband at 2:30 to go pick up the kids because I couldn't leave the house. And I just kept reading till I finished 2 days later," or something like that. And she says, "How did you manage to do that? How did you manage to keep me in there?" And I pointed to my editor who was sitting two rows behind. I said, "It's because every sentence, every page, every hundreds of pages that didn't serve the purpose and that didn't keep you hooked, she was very willing to cut, and I trusted her."
That didn't drive the narrative, but
that didn't drive the narrative.
Even that serves, of course, an invaluable purpose. The quiet censor that's going to be painful. I remember there was a wonderful playwright that I was working with, and he excised during the previews, excised most of the laughs in scenes because they didn't drive the narrative. That was very painful.
It is painful.
His name was Neil Simon. and that's a very brave thing to do. With the seduction of the laugh, But he says, "No, that doesn't help the character. It's more than you need." And that's why Neil Simon was Neil Simon. but there's a section that I wish you could read. It's a more sober section in the book.
Yes.
As an example of the kind of experience that is embedded in this book. Would you please?
I would. Yeah.
Thank you.
So this particular scene, I should set it up, is Marion Stone, the character in the book who tells the story. Marion does not think he's on a quest for his father. He, in fact, As far as he's concerned, his father is Dr. Ghosh. He has no interest in Thomas Stone, his biological father. But obviously his subconscious mind is leading him toward his father. And one day he actually comes across his father, discovers that he's at a certain place. And he shows up, Marion Stone does, for morbidity and mortality conference when surgeons get together and discuss their mistakes. And Marion does not identify himself. He sits in the back row. He's presumed to be just one of these surgical candidates interviewing for an internship. And a case is discussed. The resident is chewed up for all the mistakes that he or she made. And then Thomas Stone, his father, whom he's never really seen in the flesh before, stands up and says the following. He pulled out a piece of paper from his pocket and he unfolded it. And he said, I take responsibility for something addressed in this letter. His accent was fairly British, the years in America having softened it, but without accruing any jarring inflections. He said, this letter came to me from the deceased patient's mother. I want to make sure that this does not happen again, and here is what she says. Dr. Stone, my son's terrible death is not something I will ever get over, but perhaps in time it will be less painful. But I cannot get over one image, a last image, that could have been different. Before I was asked to leave that room in a very rough manner, I must tell you that I saw my son was terrified, and there was no one who addressed his fear. The only person who tried was a nurse. She held my son's hand and she said, don't worry, it will be all right. Everyone else ignored him. Sure, the doctors were busy with his body. It would have been merciful if he had been unconscious. They had important things to do. They cared only about his chest and his belly, not about the little boy who was in fear. Yes, he was a man, but at such a vulnerable moment, he was reduced to a little boy. I saw no sign of the slightest bit of human kindness. My son and I were irritants. Eventually, they got their wish. Dr. Stone, as head of surgery, perhaps as a parent yourself, do you not feel some obligation to have your staff comfort the patient? My son's last conscious memory will be of people ignoring him. My last memory of him will be of my little boy watching in terror as his mother is escorted out of the room. It is the graven image I will carry to my deathbed. The fact that people were attentive to his body does not compensate for their ignoring his being. Thomas Stone folded the letter and put it away in his breast pocket. There was a rustle in the auditorium, a murmur, an uncomfortable shifting of body weight. I sensed a willingness in the room to shrug off the letter, to scoff at what it said. But Stone's demeanor made it necessary to conceal that urge. Stone stood there, silent, looking out, as if considering the letter's context himself, unaware of the audience. No one spoke. As the moment stretched on, even the smallest noises were stilled until there was only the hum of the air conditioning. Thomas Stone's expression was reflective, certainly not angry. Now, as if waking up, he searched the room for a reaction, seeing if the writer had struck a chord. The scoffers had reconsidered their position. When Stone finally spoke, it was to ask in a very quiet voice that was firm and commanded attention. It was to ask a question. I knew the answer, because it was in his book, a book I'd read carefully and more than once in my voyage out of Ethiopia. What treatment in an emergency is administered by ear? Surely, with about 200 people in the room, at least 50 would know the answer. No one spoke. He waited. The discomfort grew even more acute. I could sense Constance stiffening next to me. Thomas Stone spread his feet and he put his hands behind his back. He appeared willing to stand there all day. He raised his eyebrows, waiting. The students sitting to my left were too scared to blink. Stone looked over to me, surprised to see a response from the row of dark suits. I felt his eyes bore into mine. It was only the second time he registered my being in this world. The first was when I was born. This time, I only had to raise my hand. Yes, he said. Tell us, please, what treatment in an emergency is administered by ear? All eyes were on me. I was in no hurry at all. None at all. How unjust it was that Thomas Stone's reward for his failings, for his selfishness, should be to preside in that chair and command the respect and awe and the admiration of the likes of Constance and the others in the room. Surely you couldn't be a good doctor and a terrible human being. Surely the laws of man, if not of God, did not allow it. I met his gaze. I did not blink. Words of comfort, I said to my father. The intervening years lay compressed between us as if by bookends. The others in the room looked back from my face to his, distressed, uncertain if mine was the right answer, but no one else existed for me or for him. Thank you, he said, his voice altered. Words of comfort. He left the room, but looked back at me once when he reached the door. Bravo.
Thomas Stone is the great open wound throughout the novel and the great ghost.
Indeed.
He's never seen, but he's always felt. And they had never met. Well, with that, I think it's time for questions. Sure. Thank you, Abraham.
How did you deal with the shock as a young doctor and were thrown with your expertise in infectious disease into the galley of AIDS?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear the entire question.
How did you deal emotionally with what you were faced with without available treatment, cure, and did you develop post-traumatic stress, depression?
So the question is, how did I deal with the death of HIV patients without a cure? It was actually a very difficult time because these were young men who were approximately my age. I kept seeing myself in them. And, you know, it was doubly poignant for that reason. And I'm not sure if post-traumatic stress disorder is the right term, but I clearly felt that my life course had altered. And for me, the seminal moment was 5 years into taking care of these patients in the small town in Tennessee. The hospital administrator one day invited me into his office and he said, Abraham, do you think we'll see more HIV in years to come? And I'm thinking, what planet did this guy come from? And I said, yeah, for sure we're going to see more HIV. And he said, but if you were not here, would we still see this many HIV-infected patients? And he had a point there because the early days were such that not everybody was willing to see these patients, and they wanted anonymity so much they would drive from great distances. But when he said that, I suddenly had this feeling that I could do this anywhere, that I did not have to keep doing it in this town. I didn't have that obligation that I'd felt all that time. And I also felt that I should take to heart the message my AIDS patients were teaching me, which is life is short, and the things you dream about, don't dream too long because life might not give you that opportunity. So I took it in a very positive way. I don't think I took it as a post-traumatic stress disorder, but I had been writing in order to keep my sanity. I told myself I would send my two stories to the Iowa Writers' Workshop. If they took me, I would go. If they didn't, I would moonlight in medicine and take a year off. But I was determined to take a break. I wanted to take care of patients with HIV the rest of my career, and so far I've been able to do that. But I recognized to do that, I would have to take long breaks. So it was a very emotional time. And, you know, my wife and I lost many good friends together. That's how we met, actually, from her AIDS volunteer work. So it was a very poignant time. And I would never want to go back to that time. And yet it was a very special time. I think it really formed me as a human being and helped me realize what's important.
If I may, once again, because of your ontology, if you will, you translated that experience to something very creative. And again, literature saved you. Didn't you stop medicine for a while and just write?
I didn't stop entirely. When I went to the Iowa Writers Workshop, I was blessed in that the chief of infectious disease at Iowa was someone who had trained me in Boston. And therefore, he was perhaps the only person in academic medicine who didn't think I was either nuts or had succumbed to alcohol, or there was some reason why I'd given up my tenured position and cashed in my 401k to go to Iowa. He understood, and he gave
me... Wasn't for the corn.
That's right, it wasn't for the corn. And he gave me the opportunity to work once a week in the clinic, which gave me in-state tuition, which is a huge blessing, and a stipend, a phenomenal sum of $272 a month, which, hey, I was making nothing at that point, so it was a big boon.
Bravo. There's a nice lady in the front here.
About 4 years ago, I had what I've come to refer to as a cardiac incident. And
a cardiac what?
Incident. And it was a scare. It wasn't a heart attack, but it was a scare. And I, through the agency of good friends, I went to see a very well-known cardiologist here in Los Angeles. And we went through all the tests and stuff. And I just had to do some things to change some patterns I had. But what struck me about the whole encounter with this very well-known man who does very good, reputable work in the world is he never once asked me about my heart. My heart. Did I have friends? Did I have family? Did I have children? Did I have a dog? Did I have work that I loved or anything to do with the heart? And I thought about that as I was driving home from the appointment. And I've wondered since then, how would I have brought that up to him? You know, I mean, he's been doing this for... I'm not particularly in awe of him. I'm not saying that, but I needed him in that moment to do his very expert medical stuff. But it felt incomplete that he, very much along the lines of what you're saying in this, especially the second piece that you read, how would I have approached him, or would we approach, any of us, approach someone like him about this other dimension?
I'm not sure that I have the answer to that, and I have a feeling that I'm probably guilty of that much of the time. I think the trick in medicine, we are so time-pressured, and I think the trick in medicine is to try and recognize those moments when everything has to wait, because that patient needs a lot more of you than you've been scheduled for. And, you know, that takes some resolve to be able to do that. But I also think that if I, for example, need heart bypass surgery, I will be looking for a very skilled technician. His bedside manner, his gruffness, won't matter as much to me than if I have a chronic illness, where the persona of the physician becomes tremendously important. So I think the acuteness of illness, the severity, conditions physicians' responses. So we give a lot of latitude to our thoracic surgeons and our people who do very skilled things. And I think we do it with some good reason. Maybe we're too easy on them. But that kind of manner will not work with someone who has chronic disease that needs to be sustained and lifted over the rest of their life with chronic dialysis, for example. And so I think we have to be different things to different people. And I'm sorry your experience is not perfect. I'm not sure how one would change that other than doing what we've done several times, which is to change the physician. I was not happy that my son's pediatrician had his entire interview with my son facing the computer, when everything I teach my students is about eye contact, especially with children, getting their trust. And so we didn't go back there. So I think that's the leverage you have, is your choice of physician.
That's a quintessential image.
Thank you. I have a couple questions that are related, at least the first two are. And that is, where did you get the idea? Do you remember when you got the original idea, and what process did you go through to develop it? And then related to that is, when you were in the writing process, do you have a favorite part of the book? And then finally, unrelated, are you a Nadal or Federer person?
I think you're a neurologist testing my recent memory and recall, right? But I'll try and answer the questions. I began the book, believe it or not. I mean, I knew I had a desire to try and write a book that captured everything that I love about medicine, and yet not be naive. I know that medicine has a very dark side. I wanted to capture that. I wanted to write a book that showed how medicine could save you, because we all often go into medicine because we're slightly wounded. And I also wanted to show how medicine could also undo you. But I began with an image of a very beautiful South Indian nun giving birth all of a sudden without warning in a mission hospital in Africa. That was the central image that I carried for many years before I ever embarked on the book. And I would strongly advise anyone from beginning a novel with such little material in their mind. And in the two schools of writing and how you proceed on a book, I certainly began with an image and a voice that I tried to push forward. And a doctor of another Sun Valley regular said, I think at Sun Valley, that writing is very much like driving at night with your headlights on. You don't see the whole road, but you see enough and you eventually get to your destination. And then you contrast that with John Irving, who feels very strongly that if you are writing a novel, you have to know the whole story. How else do you decide what to conceal from the reader and what to reveal, when to reveal? And he says, if you're just making it up as you're going along, you're not a novelist, you're an ordinary liar. You're just a, you know, a liar telling fibs and making the plot progress. And I think the truth is somewhere in between. I found that there was an antique voice I had in mind. There was this image, and I pushed it forward, and there were many dead ends, lots of time wasted, and there came a point where I had to sort of try and figure out what was going to happen, and sat with my editor and literally hammered out a plot. And even then, there were tremendous surprises. And so along the way, I think, even though now when I had the plot, I felt relieved. Now I knew what path to follow, but there were still tremendous surprises, because I think that's the great joy of writing, is that, you know, there are, you know, it's a discovery process. You're not writing down what you already figured out in your head. You're writing to discover. And it requires you to be in the chair. It requires you to apply yourself. The second question, my biggest moment of discovery was precisely in that, towards the very end of the book. I remember it was Christmas time. It was sort of a hectic time. My youngest son was visiting, and we were in a temporary apartment, and I was pulling late nights trying to meet this deadline. And there was an epiphany on how the twins' fate would end, and I can't tell you more, or what would happen to them. And I literally cried when that happened, because it was just, it just seemed to me so perfect. I could not have planned it. It could have only emerged organically from literally the blood, sweat, and toil of the years and years and years of writing that book when, you know, when other people were doing more fun things, perhaps. And so that was a great moment. And your third question, I want Federer to prevail, only because I'm a great fan of the classic game, you know, the slice and the approach and the volley. But I greatly admire Nadal for the kind of tenacity that I also saw in Lendl. I was a great fan of Lendl when nobody liked Lendl. So Lendl was the Antichrist. I was his only fan, I think. So I see some of those qualities of perseverance in Nadal. But Federer's game is one for the ages. And if you are a novelist, you want that to prevail. And he's clearly losing an edge right now. Behind you.
Medical students, of course, specialize in a lot of scientific work. What is the reaction of your students, and are you happy with it, when you introduce or perhaps specialize a little bit more in the humanities and the medical ethics part of it?
You know, the medical students, I find, come to medicine with all the right qualities. They really are quite just remarkable, wherever I've been. A tremendous capacity to imagine the suffering of patients. And the problem is not theirs, really. The problem is ours, that in the translation from the pre-clinical to the clinical years, or as I call it, the pre-cynical to the cynical years, we do something to them. You know, in teaching them disease and molecular biology and pathogens, they lose sight of the human condition. They sometimes forget that it's a person in the bed, you know, back to the William Carlos Williams phrase. So I found that when I was in San Antonio teaching humanities in the big lecture hall, it was a real effort, and I had to be very dramatic to grab their attention, because they become very bottom-line oriented. Going to medical school is very hard. You know, if you go to college, you're drinking from a little garden hose. You go to medical school, and you're drinking from a fire hydrant. Literally, they give you books this size, and there's a test the next week, and there's four subjects like that. So from our own pressure on them, they become very bottom-line oriented. You might try and remind them of the humanity, but it's easy for that to slip away. One of the reasons I took the job at Stanford was the opportunity to get back to the bedside. I love teaching students one-on-one at the bedside or in small groups when I'm taking care of a ward. And it might seem inefficient to be taking care of three students versus 100 in the classroom, but if I really impact the three students the way I was impacted by my mentors, if I do it well, then I think of the thousands of interactions that they might have, and I think it's very worth the effort. And at the bedside, I will put a Chekhov short story in a student's hand and not explain why, but say, let's, you and I discuss this tomorrow. And I find that that's much more effective, I'm sad to say, than the syllabus. Even though that was very popular, it was very hard work. And mandating anything immediately turns people off. So medical students would arrive, and they were all excited that, you know, the course had humanities in it and all that. But as soon as they got into it, it was like, well, will this be on the exam? And what do I need to know? So it changes everything.
Chekhov helps for everything, I think.
I wanted to know if there's one thing that you could change in medicine today, what would that be?
I think it's very clear that what we would change is the fractured way that we take care of patients right now. It's just a very complex, expensive way. We spend about $7,200 per patient in this country, per capita. That's our expenditure. It's twice that of most other countries, and by every measurable index, we're delivering worse healthcare. And about a third or maybe half that cost is from duplicated insurance systems, paperwork, bureaucracy, red tape. So if I would change one thing, it would be a one-payer system, which would immediately diminish costs. And the money you save, I think you could easily insure everybody. Massachusetts has done it. They've insured everybody. I think that's the first step. The second step, which they're facing as of today, is that the costs are just running out of control, and now you have to impose curbs and limits.
Yeah,
and,
unfortunately, they're running a fiscal problem.
But it can be done. I think it's quite feasible.
Hi, I'm a naturopathic doctor here in Los Angeles, and mostly I just want to say thank you so much for your authenticity and your humility, and I'm just so grateful that you are a teacher that exists out there in the allopathic medical world. So thank you, truly. My question to you is, how do you balance having enough sort of a porous wall to have energetic exchange with your students and your patients while maintaining good boundaries for yourself emotionally, spiritually, energetically?
Thank you so much for your earlier comment. I'm not sure that I've been very successful at keeping boundaries with my students or patients for that matter. Many of my patients became my best friends. My wife and I met because of a former patient who was my best friend who, you know, we took care of in our house. I think too much is made of the boundaries. I agree that boundaries can make you lose objectivity. With a medical student, one of my medical students, I became very close to him, and he subsequently relapsed into intravenous cocaine addiction and took his own life. And it's a story that I told in The Tennis Partner. And, you know, I think I was sort of held to account in some ways by my colleagues for allowing him to get that close. But the way I saw it was that the gift of his friendship was tremendous. It really made me realize that friendships are not incidental to our existence. They are really at the heart of our remaining healthy and being engaged. And so I've never sort of bought into that whole business about distance and propriety. I mean, obviously, you have to be careful not to have it misconstrued. But as long as your conscience is clear, I've never worried about that.
I have a question over here.
Where are you? Okay.
And again, thank you so much for this conversation. I'm so aware of the empathy between the two of you, and I wondered if you could. I was thinking about how you both create character in your respective professions, and if you could talk a little bit about how that process works for each of you and how it might differ in, you know, Hector coming off the page, and you, but still you both have to have a imagine someone into being, I assume.
Do I have to talk?
Please.
For crying out loud.
Hector told me earlier that this would be like kabuki theater where he's not seen, just barely heard. I said, no way.
I would be a black shroud Can you reframe that in the two penny way? How do I approach a character?
What are the similarities and differences, would you say, between the novelist's approach to making a character and the way an actor has to make someone come alive?
Well, as an actor, you're the great storyteller. You're practicing a very, very ancient tradition. You're coming from the theater, New York theater, back in the late 50s, early 60s. I realized, fortunately, at a prime time, that I was pursuing something that was part of a tradition of Homo sapiens, which was telling the story around the campfire. It was an extension of that, except that there were more people. The campfire was larger. So I considered myself an intermediary between author and audience. And as that kind of conduit, that kind of unit, then I felt proud to be the intermediary for Tennessee Williams or Arthur Miller, or you know, great playwrights like that, or Neil Simon that I had the pleasure of working with and for. So I need the creativity of the writer. I interpret the true creative artist's work. Whereas writing a novel, well, I think you're the wind under your own wings in a novel. You are the creator. You are Genesis. That's a different approach. I should use a different voice when I say Genesis. Huh? So I think it's somewhat different. The results are classically the same. I think what we're reaching for is a communication of sorts that is very necessary to be a human being. But I think that's the basic difference. I need the writer. I need him. I need him. By the way, this is a good movie in here. Incidentally. Not kidding either.
And so if I might answer that, I think I don't think I have a method, but with each character that evolved in this book, it took a long while for them to feel real to me. And there was, you know, moments when they just seemed too one-dimensional. And with time, as layers were added, there came a moment when I kind of thought I knew what they would do next, or they had suddenly become real to me. But I think, and I would love to hear what Hector's take is on this, I think the act of writing is fundamentally mysterious. I hate to use the word muse, but something mysterious happens when you're sitting there that you can't predict often. And it lends a little something that gives this person life, almost like breathing life into the character. And I feel also very much like an intermediary, and it could only have happened by my sitting there. Had I not been there, that would not have happened. And I wonder whether the muse speaks to your interpretation of character.
Well, it's certainly a fluttering of the heart at a particular time. You were speaking before of how one approaches a work of fiction, for example. John Irving as opposed to, say, a little bit of Salman Rushdie. Incidentally, you've been compared a little bit to both of those guys. they're in good company, I might add.
I'm better looking, though, right?
It's the great aha moment. For the actor, that's why theater is so wonderful, because you get a chance to hone that, you get a chance to allow that to seep as, like osmosis into your bones. That rehearsal process, which you do not have in film and certainly don't have in television, it's instantaneous. That's when you start appreciating good writing. That's when you forget the writing. You know, who was it? A great singer. And he always performed his recitals with an accompanist. And at the end of this particular recital, they asked him what he thought of the accompaniment. He says, "I didn't realize there was an accompanist. That's how good it was." Yeah. So that's what happens during the rehearsal process. But it is a mysterious process that the. The rehearsal process unfolds somewhat like a novel, even though the words are there. Or as we say, in order not to make it seem precious back in the old days, the jokes are there. The jokes are already on the page. But when the jokes start disappearing, when the words start disappearing, if the writing is good, it leads you to that flutter of the heart. And sometimes you can write a work of fiction, which I've attempted to do from time to time. They're all in my drawer. By using the title first. Ah, blue toilet water. That means something. I can write a short. There's a short story there somehow, and it works. I mean, I've seen that work. I haven't written it yet, but somebody's going to.
Two more questions, lady on here.
Hi. Speaking of process, I'd like to go back to Hector's original question of how you find time to write in the midst of your medical career.
Yeah, it's a common question, how I find time to write. And, I obviously don't find a lot of time because my books are very slow. It took me 4 years for the first book and 4 years for the next one, 8 years for this one. So, you know, compared to Joyce Carol Oates, I'm just the snail here. But I really wouldn't have it any other way. I think that the demands of family and work only leave you so much time. I'm a big believer in the incremental method. If you do a little bit of something every day, whether it's learning to play guitar or foreign language or adding words to your vocabulary, it's amazing how that stacks up. And so the other thing I should say, because this comes up often, is I think the writing needs to be judged by its writing, not by my profession. The fact that I'm a physician is almost inconsequential to the work. But having said that, being a physician is completely a part of my being now, in the sense that it feels like geography, it feels like nation, this is who I am. I cannot alter that. It's the way I see the world. I would never give that up. I could not give that up any more than I could give up having been born in Ethiopia or of being of Indian origin. These seem inherent to me. So that's the stance I have on the world, and I have to write from that, and that's the time I have. The other great thing that I think is in my favor is that I don't get me wrong, this sounds strange when I say this, but I'm not lacking in ambition for my books. I want them to do the best. And you know, frankly, this is like a little dream for me to be sitting on the stage in L.A. with Hector and having this dialogue. So what more could I possibly want? I have great ambitions for my book, but it doesn't have to happen tomorrow. So I was very content to take my time and get it right. And blessed to have a great day job, unlike my classmates from Iowa, many of whom had to pay the bills with, you know, writing that they were pitching here and there. And I've had the luxury of not having to worry about that. So I think if you don't watch too much TV, it's amazing how much time is freed up.
Remember, this lady has had her hand raised. I think she's going to...
This is our last question.
Blood is draining from
Thank
her
you.
Wrist.
On the other side of medicine, when a body is donated to medicine, is the real purpose to find the cure for disease, or is it just to whatever disease that person had is helpful to you?
So if I get your question right, when the body is donated to medicine, I think it's not usually to... help teach about a disease. It's really to teach anatomy, unless it's being donated for a particular purpose. So I think that's what you're asking. The Willed Body Program that many schools have are really opportunities where people make an extraordinary generous gift to the school of their body, and a medical student class benefits from that. And actually, at every school I've been at, there's a very moving ceremony at the end of the year where those remains are then taken by the students and cremated and put into a special place. So it's very moving, but it's about anatomy. It's not really about learning about disease per se.
I wasn't sure. Thank you.
So there is a purpose in life.
May I perhaps make a closing statement, and that is, first of all, to thank Hector, who's incredibly busy playing again at in Grey's Anatomy. I asked him earlier, how many physicians has he been in his lifetime? I've only been one. I think he's been... I want to really thank him for taking the time to make this possible. His wonderful wife, Carolee, for being here tonight, too. Thank all of you for coming. I know this
and
is...
And may I remind you all, by the way, there's a... give something to the piano player, and then there's a pot out there. Then, leave a five spot. This is a humble endeavor, but it needs your support. $5 will help out. On the desk, outside in the glass.
Thank you both so much.
Thank you very much.
A
Aloud Audio is presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the Annenberg Foundation, City National Bank, contributors to the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and Donna and Martin J. Wolf. Media support provided by KUSC 91.5 FM and KCET. Aloud theme composed by Larry Karish.